here for the first, for the first lecture of the last day of the conference. And indeed, it's a pleasure to be back to PI and be able to legally put PI logo on one of my transparencies. It's also a very important day in my scientific showman life. It will be for the first time ever that I'm going to use words ontic and epistemic in my talk. So as you can guess, no, they're not in the title. But still, they will appear there. So naturally, I'm a bit nervous. And it's also my pleasure to be the first speaker of So Australia Day here, as you can guess from the program. No, it's All Australian Day. It will be today. Well, as a known and a student of Asher Peres, you may expect certain things from my presentation, and I will try not to disappoint you too much. At the end, I'm going to show my favorite interpretation of quantum theory, but it's going to happen at the end. Before that, we have to do some physics. And before even that, I would like to show a few quotes from people who worked on relativity and or gravity. And I feel strong identification with many of them, even if the quotes may appear somewhat contradictory. So first of all, let me declare myself a realist, or more specifically, as if realist, following Rudolf Hag, where, as if realism, the facts, whether observed or not, are assumed to exist and constitute the cornerstones of the theory. We should be careful, of course, with what we mean by facts. Then, I cannot leave my favorite maxim of Asher Peres out. And yes, I'm an instrumentalist, and I'm proud of it. At least this is a version he related to me in one of our nice chats. And finally, a very interesting explanation by Steve Weinberg why wave functions are real. It smacks of utilitarianism, but still, it's an interesting perspective. They're real because it's useful to include them in our theories. In a more serious vein, we can say that we should start in our attempts to find the ultimate question of life, universe, and everything from the core data, which in the case of quantum theory, basically it's a probabilistic structure of quantum theory as revealed in calculations of measurable quantities and supported by measurements of the same measurable quantities in what Robin calls explicitly quantum or just in general normal physics, which is based on quantum theory. And this is, as I learned here, exactly what makes the instrumental or instrumentalist view, version, or meaning of quantum states. Going beyond that is not necessarily to get lost in wastelands of metaphysics, as Born put it, but it's a useful mental exercise that should be subject to consistency constraints. Motivation for this may be manifold, range from personal tastes and prejudices to hope for a better theory. And then we reach this hierarchy of interpretations or hierarchy of ideas of what quantum states are, ranging from instrumental and all the way through epistemic, ontic, and nomic, which were proposed by Hubbard. Again, to me, it seems more nominalistic than nomic, but let's not enter the philosophical interpretations here. It's an interesting exercise, and hopefully at the end we reach the final victory with our favorite interpretation, or at least our better understanding. The chain of those definitions, so hierarchy of the states, asks for analogy in form of matryoshka, you know, the Russian nested doll. But then we have a problem. What is the innermost and what is the outermost meaning of the quantum state? So nice weather conditions in Sydney last week led me to produce a better analogy. So for those who are familiar with Sydney's topography, you know that The second major landmark of Sydney's Opera House is just here on the left, just behind the bridge. Over here, we have towers of the CBD. To the right is my favorite Darling Harbour. But all we can see, all the observed information here, is the bits and pieces of the Luna Park and some part of the Harbour Bridge. To construct, or to go beyond that, we have to cross the bridge. And in this red mist, monsters are walking. So we should be careful about what we are doing and how we are going. So going beyond, we have, if we want to, of course, we have to build our constructs based on the instrumental state. And the criteria will be consistency with known experimental results and basically known predictions of quantum mechanics. And the one which is much more ambiguous, as already Einstein admitted, it's a simplicity, which probably is in the eye of an observer. Then we might reach a theory or theories that satisfy those conditions. And if yes, then of course it will be a question of uniqueness. It's unfortunately, to my taste, it's a bit like reconstructing the dinosaurs, which appeared prominently in this talk. This conference. I don't know why. It's a conference of physics, not paleontology, from fingerprints. So to finish, let me put another quote from father of realism. For physical theories, even if Newton's theory of gravity in modern lingo would be described as instrumentalist and wanting a proper realist or real interpretation. He refused to frame hypotheses, and their explanation is very neat. For whatever is not deduced from the phenomena is to be called a hypothesis, and a hypothesis whenever metaphysical or physical, of occult quantities or mechanical, have no place in experimental philosophy. Well, I'll be less strict with it, well, just because I'm not Newton, or higher, but we'll try to see what actually relativity can tell us and what we can learn from applying lessons from relativity to questions in quantum theory. There are many levels at which relativity can be applied. First of all, we can just use special relativity. Our models of quantum system are basically point-like system without much spatial structures. You can think about them as just qubits or qudits. And then what observers or external agents do are the classical interventions. We assume that the laws of special relativity hold, and we try to figure out what follows from, say, causality constraints or other special relativistic features. So we learn about restrictions on quantum operations. But this is not my subject today. We'll learn about the absence of transformation laws for quantum states when we are outside the common light cones of the interventions. And I will talk about it later. Then we can go to the next level and use quantum field theory. From it, we'll learn about the fuzziness in identification of systems and their components. We learn that localization is non-sharp. We see that entanglement is pervasive. And again, reality becomes more messy, more complicated, mutatable, exactly the way I like. That's our second topic for today. Holography, coming for whatever reason, which in the uncontroversial way can be spelled as something like a suitably defined entropy is proportional to a suitably defined area of a suitably defined boundary surface. It's a deep and interesting idea and has a lot of fantastic applications in many branches of physics. I love playing with it. It might be telling us things about quantum theory, but I doubt that it has a direct implications on the interpretation of quantum states. So I'll skip this subject for today. Naturally, quantum gravity brings us to the questions of absence of time and non-local observables, just because Wheeler-DeWitt equation is timeless, and observables should commute with constraints. However, the same problem is in general relativity, in classical general relativity, and other constraint theories. And it seemed to be that those problems are handled quite naturally in the relational formalism. Again, we heard about it, and I think I don't have to say more. The wave function of the universe, well, already the name sounds wacky enough to be suitable for conference on quantum foundations. Again, it's interesting and deep subject. You heard some stuff about it. I don't think that I have to say more. On the other hand, the black hole information problem, which brings us to the question of unitarity in quantum theory, conservation of information, again, to be honest, I have to admit, I'm not sure how much influence it has on question instrumental versus ontic versus epistemic, but it's an interesting subject. I love it. So I would like to talk a bit about it. Another reasonable area in which we definitely see influence from relativistic considerations to quantum theory is closed time-like loops and how to do quantum theory with them. But I leave this subject entirely in capable hands of Steve Bartlett, who will talk just after me. So let's start. We begin with space-like interventions and Lorentz transformations. So we have very simple notion of quantum theory at this stage. Either qubits, that something happens to them, or non-interacting free, well-identified particles. So let us see what can we do with few classical interventions similar to the stuff that Yakir Aronov presented a few days ago. So we have our two systems which are non-interacting, two subsystems if you wish, and we have two classical observers. If we're talking about quantum mechanics, and they, in certain reference frame, they perform their operations. Let's say they perform measurements, which are probabilistic outcomes here and there, and they happen simultaneously. To make life more interesting, we add also two moving observers. Naturally, they're called Alice and Bob. Depending on whose reference frame you are in, those are exactly the people who performed those measurements. So depending on whom reference frame you are in, it is either Alice who did it first or Bob who kicked it first. So what does it tell us about the transformation laws for quantum states? The example that I would like to present you is much simpler than Aronov's and Albert example. We don't need entangled states to get something weird. On the other hand, we don't have nice bouncing back of the weirdness. As an extra bonus, we can connect it to a classical theory. So let us consider two states which are just indirect product. No entanglement whatsoever. Let's say the initial state of first qubit and the second qubit on, from the previous slides are spin up and spin up. When we transform this state to the reference frame of Alice or reference frame of Bob, we have to do some unitary transformation, which is well known, absolutely uncontroversial. So I just, when I write sigma z in Alice's frame, I mean just sigma z from Eve, appropriately transformed, just to save on the notation. We'll see some interesting effects from those transformations a bit later, but now we just take sigma x, sigma y, or whatever, from one frame to another. And let us consider one particular history. In this history, Alice at time zero measures in y direction, gets the result up. Bob measures in x direction, gets the result down, measurement happen at t0 in this common frame. If we transform, it happens at t equals 0 in each of the personal frames. However, if we are following the story, so Alice goes first in her frame. So from a nice common state, it comes to sigma y1. Sigma z is still 1 in Alice's frame. And only later, it turns into Bob's result. It's updated according to Bob's result. Sigma x is minus 1. If, yeah. No. They're moving. They're both moving with respect to even. They have to move in different directions. Otherwise, they will, because I need that they have different reference frames. Otherwise, there will be no disagreement between Alice's time and Bob's time. Yeah. Just let them move with constant velocity, let's say, in opposite directions along the x-axis. So in Bob's frame, the sequence is, of course, the opposite. First, his state changes, then Alice's state changes at some later time, which actually depends on the on Bob's velocity. There is an agreement. What is important is exactly as in Aronoff's example, for that particular chunk of space-time outside the light cones, there is a disagreement. Actually, not a disagreement. There is no disagreement about measurable results. There is just no transformation law which is independent of the history between the states of Alice and the states, states as described by Alice and the states as described by Bob. Yeah? Oh, well, actually, this picture, I think, is sufficient. So there are two particles. Alice goes along the x-axis with certain velocity, passes through here. Bob goes along x-axis with in different direction, passes through here. According in this common, in this reference frame on the picture, let's say Eve's reference frame, both Alice and Bob grab this their respective particle at time t equals 0 and perform measurement that we take as instantaneous. And Alice's perform measurement in y direction and gets certain result. Bob performs measurement in x direction, gets a certain result, and they do nothing else. So we can get a story which tells us how the state was transformed from this to that. And in this whatever, basic reference frame, Eve's reference frame, it happened at time t equals 0. We do instantaneous update. And from now on, the state of those two particles is this. And next step, what I'm doing is just to consider how those things happened in Alice's frame. Then the update sequence is more complicated. And then I look at how this thing looks in Bob's frame. The point is that it's very similar to a classical story, and we'll see a bit more of space-time diagrams there, and probably that will become easier to accept. So analogous classical model, two classical particles, they bounce back and forth somewhere here and somewhere there. Instead of Alice and Bob doing something, they do nothing. They just observe. So they perform measurement, or actually they don't. It's classical story, so if they perform measurement, they know everything. If they just update the information, there is a bit of a complication. What happens in the story is at time t0, according to the clock of Eve, a classical stochastic intervention happens. So those particles are hit either in plus x or minus x direction. So their energies change in either E plus or into E minus. And that happens with a probability of 50%. So the classical story, if we represent projection of Liouville function into the energy plane, is that we have this point after this classical intervention, we have a nice four-point story, all the combinations of E plus with E minus. We will know where we are if we do a measurement. If we don't, this is our best update for the Louisville density. Now we look how this story is told to, by Alice. In her frame, the intervention with this particle happens before intervention with second particle. So just after this hit, in her reference frame, the Louisville density will look like this. For Bob, the story happens in the other order, in opposite order. So according to his clock, the intermediate step of the story is this. And only in the common future, what they have will be appropriate transform of this four-point story. So a moral, as I would like to draw from here, is that first, as it was known quite a while, so long as we are within, so common light, past light cone of the outside interventions, or in the intersection of future time light cone of the external interventions, we are fine. We do have transformation laws. But when we are in this diamond, actually more than diamond, diamond and a bit more in the middle, there is no transformation law between the descriptions in Alice's and Bob's frame. And second, this is not a quantum feature. It's a feature of any theory which has some external agent, exosystem, which is not, whose dynamics is not described by the theory. In quantum case, it was about measurement, which is results are stochastic. In classical case, it was just overt stochastical intervention. No, you hit something. It's in the random direction. So stochasticity is what is responsible for the lack of the transformation law. Going to another part of special relativistic story is what quantum Lorentz transformation tell us about a system. Let us consider single particle, massive or massless. Actually, as an example, it's easier to consider a massive particle, even if for practical purposes and for fun, photons are more interesting. The transformation law for quantum states, which follows the Lorentz transformation from one reference frame to another reference frame, was discovered by Wigner 70 years ago. And it can be encoded in the form of a nice circuit. The Lorentz transformation is the classical info wire. Particle has momentum degrees of freedom and discrete degrees of freedom, which may be considered to be either spin, if it's a massive particle, or polarization, if it's a massless particle. What happens to momentum is just an appropriate Lorentz transformation. What happens to spin is a certain unitary, which generally depends not only on the classical info, but also on the value of momentum. We can get rather explicit expressions for what are those things. It turns out that for spin, it's just certain unitary rotation, as I said, if typically will depend both on Lorentz transformation and on the momentum, and only for pure rotations is momentum independent. For photons, helicity is preserved, but the phase gets rather nasty, complicated expression, which, of course, is a source of a lot of joy for theorists. That's the explicit form of those expressions is not our concern for today. What we are concerned with is a density matrix for those discrete degrees of freedom. Again, let us leave aside now photons, because there are many delightful complications. Let's concentrate on massive particles. For those massive particles, we define spin density matrix in a standard way, by tracing out momentum wave functions. What we discovered, which is pretty obvious after you look at the quantum circuit that represents Wigner's transformation for quantum states, is that, well, partial trace is not a Lorentz covariant concept. The result spin entropy is not Lorentz invariant. And, well, distinguishability and all other quantum informational tasks that you would like to perform on your spin qubits depend on the relative motion. Now, it has a very easy intuitive explanation. The transformation law for spin depends on the momentum. The moment you trace out the momentum, you just killed half of the sources of your of the information that you need to transform. So it's not a surprise that this happens. As a concrete example, we can take a state which in Ellis's frame is sharply centered on zero, so it's basically at rest with some tails, and has a pure spin state. At least at the level of imagination, we can always pretend that that's possible for massive particles. So its density matrix is just pure state density matrix, and we let Bob to move with certain velocity along, say, z-axis. Then doing transformation, doing the expansions, by a certain amount of calculations, we get an expression for Bob's density matrix. Of course, not by transforming Alice's density matrix directly, but by transforming the entire state and then taking a partial trace. What we see that there is a crucial parameter, which partly depends on velocity, but, well, not very profoundly, and most importantly, on the ratio of typical width to typical energy. Then we can calculate all kinds of interesting quantities. One of them is the entropy of this reduced density matrix, which with certain variations, but in general, in the same general direction, is increasing, increasing together with this cumulative parameter gamma, and of course is zero only for zero relative velocity. So what we see here, because for pure states, and remember, it was pure overall state unitarily transformed to another frame, so it's a pure state. Entropy is the degree of entanglement. So spin and momentum, nothing real happened. We moved from one frame to another frame, became entangled. We can argue that the idea of what is subsystem is frame dependent, or at least we see that entanglement between different degrees of freedom, probably definitions actually of different degrees of freedom, are dependent, are frame dependent, just because what we do with spin depends on the momentum. It's even more obvious, or more so for polarization, where the polarization plane depends on the momentum. So, well, I prefer not to draw any moral story out of it. It's up to you. Now, let us talk about what can we learn from quantum field theory. Again, those are old stories, really coming from axiomatic or algebraic field theory derived in between 60s and 80s, and just stated in terms what does it do to quantum information, and what does it do to us if we're interested in basic notions on foundations. First of all, a bit of a language, a bit of good background news. The way quantum information toys are formulated, so completely positive dynamics, the formalism of POVMs, all this goes to relativistic domain without any problem, even to the case of quantum gravity. I mean, the resolution of identity is the resolution of identity if you have an appropriate Hilbert space. So there is no problem with applying any of the quantum informational formalism. The objects which people who derive those results generally think in those terms are algebras of local or quasi-local operators with given canonical commutation or anti-commutation relations. states are typically considered to be just functionals on algebras of those local operators, naturally with certain properties, and Hilbert spaces are usually a derived concept. Of course, it works in full generality of the form is only on free field theories, which we know how to deal with already, but still it's quite nice. So what we need as a local operator is the operator value distribution, which is smeared by nice with a nice function either across a space-time domain or across just a time slice, just to have well-defined operatorial objects. And two bits of lingo. Local means that this smearing function has a compact or the bounded support. Quasi-local, f is fastly decreasing with exponentially decaying or faster tails. Then, quite naturally, a few theorems come out. One of them is Riesz-Schlieder theorem, which again sounds as a bit of abstract nonsense at the first sight. The set of states generated from the vacuum by the polynomial algebra of operators, which are associated with any bounded region, is dense in the Hilbert space of all field states. If you think a bit about it, it implies that there are local operators, local in the precise sense from the previous slide, when applied to vacuum, produces a state that is arbitrarily close to any arbitrary state, including any entangled state you wish. Of course, to write this operator explicitly, let alone produce it in the lab, it's a different business. Another theorem which is important for those of us who think about the ultimate efficiency. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh, no. It's operator we consider only products or arbitrary products which still belong to the algebra of local operators, which are those are still local. So the algebra of those operators is closed. Yeah, no, we don't have to go to something which becomes non-local. You really stick to the to prescribe the region of space-time. Otherwise, it wouldn't be that nice or surprising. Another theorem is Epstein-Glaser-Jaffe theorem, which basically tells us that if we have a local positive operator, and the expectation value of this positive operator on the vacuum is zero, then this operator is identically zero. So one corollary we can say it like this. No local operator annihilates the vacuum. That means detectors must have dark counts, no matter what you do. Of course, as any existence, uniqueness and existence proof, it doesn't tell you how much. That's a different business. It's much more complicated business. But at least we have to know that there is no such thing as an ideal detector. Next step is rather nice. We see that POVMs are, well, if we can say it a bit strongly, are not the resolutions of identity. Yeah. Oh, no. If it's a positive operator. If it's operator. So one of the ways out is that we can have negative energy densities in quantum field theory. So this is why, for example, you cannot build a nice POVM out of energy density and you will run into all kinds of problems. Yeah, positive local. Positive local. So why this statement, or exactly more exactly what does it mean? So consider non-overlapping regions. We associate somehow localization POVM element to each of those regions using usual rules of POVM analysis, we consider them, so the sum of those P of M elements is the identity. We calculate the sum of the probabilities, take the expectation value with the vacuum. You can use translation invariance. We get that this thing is 1. So it will be really useless detector. It always fires at vacuum. So useful detectors will have a non-zero chance to fail even if the excitation is present. So we will always have dark counts, and there will be always be having a chance to fail even if there is something real. Oh, well, then the news that localization POVM cannot be built from local operators come as not really such terrible news. So let's consider the, again, regions of space. They add up together with to form our space manifold. Next step, we use the invariance of the vacuum state. So we pick up, look at one disjoint bin. Remember, it's positive operator, so its vacuum expectation value is non-zero. So we get some epsilon. But then we're picking up those disjoint bins to get n epsilon greater than 1. We're reaching a nice contradiction. What's worse, and the proof is much more involved, is that localization POVM is not even quasi-local. So we have to have tails which are more than exponential. Well, a moral of the story, space-time events can be defined only by non-local procedures, and everything else is fuzzy. And what is real is just real because it's real with very high probability. A bit more, so entangled state can be approximated locally by acting on a vacuum, even if we know that if we go to sufficiently far separated spatial regions, the correlations decay very fast. For massive particles, they decay exponentially. For massless particles, they decay polynomially. Of course, detector efficiency was proven to play the role of effective mass and give the exponential cutoff. Well, we see this entanglement, for example, in Andrew effect. And let me announce yet another property, which not harmful for practical calculations, is that local partial trace, so associated to region of space, do not produce a trace class operator. One of the examples, one of the few that we can do explicitly, are with Unruh effect, where we introduce Rindler coordinates on the two wedges, so, and then perform a new quantization scheme, do Bogoliubov transformation, which turns out to be only a formal transformation, and then, yeah, we write it as a unitary. Every mode is a nice normalizable state with the partition function, which is finite, but we have product of all possible modes. If we write it in terms of wave packets, we can get it into countable form and rather naturally put cutoffs. But per se, as a mathematical object, a reduced density operator is ill-defined. Let me tell you a final story for today about black holes. And I have to apologize. Most of it will be just setting the background and then just one slide to punchline without much technical details, but I hope you'll enjoy it. First of all, I have to tell you, and I guess many of you know it, that black holes predate general relativity. They first were proposed more than 100 years before Einstein equations. By the way, what do you see here, these long lines? It's not the abstract. It's the title. This is how they did in the olden days. It's a letter from Reverend John Mitchell to Right Honorable Henry Cavendish, the same Cavendish to measure Newton constant. And it's a long astronomical paper. And in part 16, Mitchell discusses massive bodies, so massive that all light coming from such a body would be made to return towards it by its own proper gravity. And then here does a calculation, and the calculation purely Newtonian is correct up to the factor of 2, which you can get only out of general relativity. As an example, let's consider Schwarzschild metric. We can get the proper time for stationary observers. An interesting parameter, of course, is gravitational radius, which in my units, speed of light, well, my units, units of gravity people, speed of light equals Newton constant equals h bar equals 1, is just twice the mass. We have a coordinate singularity, which is a horizon. Physical singularity corresponds to r equals 0. An important parameter is surface gravity, which is force per unit mass, as measured at infinity, that you need to apply to keep the observer stationary just outside the horizon. There are alternative there is at least one alternative definition. For this black hole, it's just 1/4 times mass. What's remarkable is that there are laws of black hole dynamics, classical GR, so no violation of energy conditions, which are remarkably similar to the laws of thermodynamics. There is Zero's law, which tells us that surface gravity is constant on the horizon for any stationary black hole. There is the first law, which relates mass and area, and the surface gravity plays a role of coefficient. Okay, angular momentum as well. So looks surprisingly like the first law if mass is energy, area is entropy, and then sort of K is temperature. This stage is a bit far-fetched. And there is a second law. Again, classical GR, any process, horizon area can only increase. That led to the introduction of Bekenstein, now Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, with in right units, entropy proportional to 1/4 of the area. The question, what is temperature, was supplied by Hawking radiation, which related temperature to the surface gravity over 2 pi, and led to a finite evaporation time of a black hole. And I mean finite from the point of view of a distant observer at infinity, where coordinate time is just the physical time. And it led to the infamous information loss problem. If we consider evolution of matter, which collapses into black hole and then this black hole radiates, we have to conclude that the quantum state of a matter from, say, being pure evolves into a mixed state. I think the most concise and still reasonable exposition of this paradox is given by a paper of Bob Wald, which just described it like this. A black hole evaporates via the Hawking process within a finite time. If the correlations between the inside and outside of the black hole are not restored during the process, then by the time that the black hole has evaporated, an initial pure state will have evolved to a mixed state, that is, information will have been lost. Now, let's stress inside and outside of the black hole. It played an important role in whatever attempts to explain away or accept or show that there is no such information loss. Very nice book which covers all aspects of black hole physics is by Frolov and Novikov. Those are just sample of 3 recent papers which deal with different aspects of the problem by arguing why it is not there, while the review of Oppenheimer and Resnick picks up the point, what if quantum mechanics is non-unitary and how it squares with the conservation laws? And they also discuss a nice model how to leave it at the fundamental level. My point for today is that, well, matter is an open system. Then those 3 equations I lie. It's a very useful lie. Real life is more complicated. I'm using them just to illustrate the point in a most simple way. So then we consider the initial state as a state of gravity, direct product, state of geometry, state of matter, something which is near Liminkovskian, but with such initial condition that actually collapses. Then we should have unitary evolution. I can discuss what are the reasons for it if you wish. And then the final state, late time state, is just unitary evolution of this initial state. And then the state of matter is a partial trace of the gravitational geometric degrees of freedom. Again, pure state goes to a pure state, and matter entropy, which is entropy of the reduced density matrix, is just a measure of entanglement. So it's not a measure of loss of information, but just of its redistribution. That's interesting. Together with Vicar-Hossain, we moved a few steps in making this program concrete and defining precisely what we need to establish. However, abstracting from the details, it gave me a very sort of trivial observation, which somehow never been made before. If there is a quantum gravity theory, in this particular case, it should give us a unitary dynamics. Now, all candidate theories, I mean, strings, loops, forms, are unitary. So if there is a successful theory of quantum gravity, and successful, I mean, not produces some interesting mathematical effects, but actually can take care of coupled matter gravity and get some nice and distant semi-classical thing. In this theory, there is no information loss, period. So information loss and quantum gravity in any shape or form are incompatible. They rise and fall in sort of in perfect anti-correlation. Of course, it doesn't mean that there is no apparent information loss, but it's another topic, very fascinating, but not suitable for today. So let me summarize. Starting from arguments of Aronoff and Albert, we can, and going to free field theory, and then jumping to our games with black holes, we can see that identity is fuzzy. Constituents of the systems are only approximate. Separation is approximate. Locality is unsharp. Interventions destroy the transformation laws. Some of the weirdness is actually purely classical. And black holes do not destroy information, or neither of strings, loops, and forms is correct. Finally, as promised, let me introduce my favorite interpretation of quantum theory. I call it Rushdie Adams' interpretation of quantum theory. It's based on one quote and one cartoon. So the quote is from The Ground Beneath Your Feet, that in the age of great uncertainty, it's easy to mistake science for banality and to believe that Heisenberg is merely saying, gee, guys, we just can't be sure of anything. It's so darn uncertain. But isn't that, like, beautiful? Whereas, actually, he's telling us the exact opposite, that if you know what you are doing, you can pin down the exact quantum of uncertainty in any experiment and in any process. The knowledge and mystery, we can now ascribe percentage points. A principle of uncertainty is also a measure of certainty. It's not a lament about shifting sands, but a gauge of the solidity of the ground. And of course, the famous advice, don't panic. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks, Danny. I love the example of swapping the entanglement between the spin and the spatial degrees of freedom. Now, what happens if we model the measuring apparatus on both sides of the wings of this experiment? So we're going to do an EPR experiment, and we've entangled the spin degrees of freedom, and we think, well, let's do a couple of Stern-Gerlach measurements with Alice and then with Bob. Now, presumably, those measurements will, in one frame, they'll give the kind of normal corresponding Bell inequality violating outcomes. Yet, one might think naively, if we shift to the other frame where the entanglement, we can put all the entanglement in the spatial degrees of freedom, this is just going to be totally the wrong experiment to demonstrate any violation of the Bell inequality at all. And so one might think, well, actually, my statistics now shouldn't violate the Bell inequality. But yet the statistics, the marks on the pieces of paper, those presumably are fixed spatiotemporal events. So my question is, when one does the transformation, when one does the boost into the other frame, does that mean the description we'd write down of the experiment we're doing also changes? So that when we translate the Stern-Gerlach apparatus, the description of the Stern-Gerlach apparatus, the unitary which would connect that spin degree of freedom to the position degrees of freedom there, does that change into saying that actually this is a measurement of position now, and so we can see, momentum, so we can see entanglement in the momentum degrees of freedom?
The answer will be, I can supply you a partial answer. Actually, there exists, after our work on that one particle state, there is a rather long literature, some of it actually predates our work, on Bell inequality violations in different reference frames. The full answer I cannot give you because there is no explicit form of a honest localization POVM which is needed to take into account also the effects of spatial distribution, of space degrees of freedom of particle. I can tell you a few other things which are established. If you just look at the level of reduced density matrices without taking into account how we actually measure, then yes, for massive particles, the degree of entanglement goes down. For sufficiently big spread to mass ratios, it can go to zero for finite velocities, but I don't think that we can speak about identity of particles or spreads. For photons, situation is even weirder. You can get either decrease or increase in degree of entanglement. Then ignoring the issues of special degrees of freedom and thinking about like point-like classical particles with quantum degrees of freedom, they have to remember that there is no unique spin operator, relativistic spin operator, and then depending on what operator you're using for description of your Stern-Gerlach experiment, you either get a decrease and washing away of Bell correlations, or you don't. It basically depends what you are using and how you are adjusting it. And again, there are papers about it. Many of them are referred to in the review paper I cited. The same answer is for, same qualitative answer is for massive particles and for photons. And one of the things that I would like to do, and I still haven't done, and I don't know about anybody who did it, to get a fully consistent, explicit form of the localization POVM and not just a bunch of theorems about what it should be and what it shouldn't. And then combine it with different spin operators, which will model different aspects how you do your Stern-Gerlach, and then see how it affects the final predictions. So far, I can give you only a partial answer, even if it's a very long one.
Other questions?
Hi, Mike Tyler. So people like Bell and Popper pointed out that the existence of instantaneous non-local interactions showed that there was, in fact, a preferred frame, the frame in which all these entanglements are absolutely simultaneous, right? So, and that suggests that the correct interpretation of relativity is actually the Neo-Lorentzian one that was around before Einstein, right? Which is experimentally entirely in agreement with the special relativistic idea that all frames are equivalent, okay? So in that viewpoint, special relativity is just a positivistic metaphysical preference. You can't detect the preferred frame, so it doesn't exist. So that gives a universe-wide distinction between the past, present, and the future, and there's a universal time, and the speed of light is constant only in that frame. And according to Maxwell's equations, length contractions occur just the real physical events caused by distortions of electric fields traveling relative to this frame. Okay, so my question is, would any of your conclusions change if such a viewpoint turned out to be the correct one?
Oh, well, The honest answer will be yes and no, because I phrased my conclusions in the way that they're rather inconclusive. What I used is the update rules for the information. And with them, there is no problem of instantaneous update and instantaneous propagation, because any measurable entity, any predicted measurable result changes only with the maximal speed of propagation or lower. So in the case of existence of true preferred reference frame, some of the, I think the considerations of, let's say like this. If we have a true preferred reference frame, then the fact that there is no transformation law between Alice's frame and Bob's frame, which presumably are not the one which is the true the frame, it wouldn't be worrisome if you want to endow your state with any realistic meaning. Just because it's both Alice and Bob, they don't have a true state. And in the frame, the one frame, everything has a, there's no problem of transformation law. So yes, so some of the conclusions will be just irrelevant, but it might be easier to get to cross this bridge from instrumentalist state to whatever other interpretation is there, just because it will be few restrictions less.
Robin?
Robin Blumko here. Sorry, loud. I have a technical clarification question about one of your earlier slides.
Yeah.
You had a theorem named after two guys, two people, that talked about what states you could access with local transformations.
Access? So, ah, Rich Leader. Okay. Yeah.
So it seems like the way it's stated, this implies that if I start with the vacuum and I apply a local operator in region A, I could create an excitation in region B, which is very, very far away. Is that right?
Yes, but again, it will not change statistics superluminally. Basically, because the vacuum is your entangled resource. So it's like in our quantum infolingo, it may be sort of you have and we share already pre-established entangled pair, and then we perform local operations and we modify to some other entangled state.
But
entanglement is already there because the vacuum is entangled.
So if I have an EPR pair and between A and B, and I do a unitary on A, I can create any maximally entangled state, but I cannot create any product state. And the way you've stated it here, I can create any arbitrary state.
No, exactly. It's one of the nice things about infinite dimensional spaces. I never stated that I can't create any state. Those gentlemen stated that you can approximate with an epsilon any state. And while in finite dimensional spaces, for all practical purposes, it would mean that I can create an infinite dimensional. I just can get some weird sequence which converges to it, but is not that. It's like in infinite dimensional spaces, if I don't put any bound, let's say, on energy, in the neighborhood of any state, I can have a state of arbitrary entropy.
Okay, one last question.
Well, Howard Wiseman, just continuing on this question, just for further clarification, when you talk about local operators being applied, you're not talking necessarily about unitaries, are you?
No.
So I mean, isn't that an important point, that it just means that there's some could infinitesimally small chance, perhaps, that you could create, you know, a product state or an entangled state
want? Actually, I can have combinations of local operators are allowed, including non-unitaries and just Hermitian stuff.
Yeah, but you could all, but anything which is not a unitary, you could interpret as being a measurement, right?
Well, actually, states. Well, so that goes out. Yeah. Well, actually, in this perspective, the measurements are associated with states and the basic. That's an interesting point. I don't know how to express measurement formalism naturally in this way. Oh no, actually, I can associate local operators with measurement. Sure.
Good.
Okay, so why don't we go get some coffee? Let's thank Danny again. Also, don't forget to put some questions on the board. It looks pretty skimpy. Well, right, Hans. Why don't you remind of the topics and the panelists? I don't recall who they were.